press. Now, while each of these factors may or may not contain a kernel of truth, none of them, individually or together, deal with the central reasons for the American failure in Vietnam. If anything, they distract attention from those central reasons. The fundamental reasons for the American failure in Vietnam lie in the realm of political failures and faulty perceptions, both of the nature of the conflict and of Vietnam itself. From the beginning of the American involvement in Vietnam, which began not in 1965, common assumption, but in 1950, if not earlier, right down to North Vietnam's military conquest of South Vietnam and the departure of the last Americans in 1975. Throughout this time period, the United States viewed Vietnam as part of its larger Cold War conflict with the Soviet Union. That was primarily because the insurgency against French colonial rule from 1945 to 1954 and then against the South Vietnamese government was led by Vietnamese communists under Ho Chi Minh. It was also due to the fact that rebuilding France as a bulwark against communist expansion in Europe was a key component of America's Cold War policy of containment. And you do not rebuild French power by supporting a revolt in the French Empire. Consequently, the United States followed a policy of benevolent neutrality toward France in the early stages of its war with Ho, and then active support of the French from 1950 to 1954. Key National Security Council documents at that time defined helping to maintain French control of Indochina as a key part of what Secretary of State Dean Acheson defined in early 1950 as the American defense perimeter in Asia and the Pacific against further communist expansion. The outbreak of the Korean War in June of 1950 strongly reinforced that decision. And consequently, the United States began to support the French in Indochina financially and in terms of military supplies. By 1954, it was paying for approximately 70% of the French war effort. But that war effort ended in failure, a failure symbolized by the communist capture of the key French fortress at Dien Bien Phu in 1954 and France's decision to sue for peace. Now, the result of this was the Geneva Conference of 1954, the withdrawal of the French, and the creation of independent states of Cambodia, Laos, and a temporarily divided Vietnam in what had been French Indochina. At that point, the United States shifted its support to the anti-communist entity below the 17th parallel, officially known as the Republic of Vietnam, and unofficially as South Vietnam, in an effort to contain the communist victory north of the 17th parallel that was the dividing line between the two Vietnams. All American efforts from that point on were directed at defending South Vietnam militarily against the attempt by both communist guerrillas in the South and the North Vietnamese army to conquer the South. These efforts started under South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem, and then, after his assassination by the South Vietnamese military in 1963, under a series of military governments. The effort was at first limited to economic and military aid, along with military advisors. But when that failed, the number of military advisors was increased dramatically under President John Kennedy. It had been 900 under President Eisenhower in early 1961. By the time of Kennedy's death in November 1963, it was up to nearly 17,000. And when that effort failed to halt the communists, President Lyndon Johnson began a sustained bombing campaign against North Vietnam and sent major U.S. military forces into the South. By early 1968, those forces numbered over 500,000, and they had largely Americanized the war. Now, those forces failed to achieve more than a military stalemate. That fact, and the damage being done by the war both domestically and internationally in terms of America's global Cold War policy and commitments, led Johnson's successor, Richard Nixon, to scale down U.S. military forces and sign a peace accord with the North. Simultaneously, Nixon tried to build up the effectiveness of the South Vietnamese army, a process known as Vietnamization. This was done at the same time Nixon was creating the policy of détente with the Soviet Union, which led him and his advisors to believe that the Soviets would hold back the communists in Vietnam while he completed this process and the American military withdrawal. The Soviets did not do so. Vietnamization failed, and the North Vietnamese army was able to conquer the South in 1975. The key problems with the whole American approach to the war were threefold. First, the South Vietnamese government was never a viable entity. Second, the Vietnam War was much more than a Cold War conflict. And third, in some ways it was not a Cold War conflict at all to the Vietnamese fighting in it. The Cold War was but one of two major international events to take place once World War II ended. The other was the decolonization of Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, as nationalist movements in these areas succeeded in throwing out the European colonial powers that had previously ruled them. But those powers had been seriously weakened by World War II. Now, many of these nationalist movements had begun long before the 1940s. In Vietnam, they had existed ever since the French had created the colony of Indochina in the 1880s. The French had forcefully suppressed early rebellions against their rule, but not the nationalist sentiments which had always been strong. Indeed, the Vietnamese had previously fought against Chinese imperialism for 1,000 years. Now, at the end of World War I, one of these Vietnamese nationalists, then living in Paris, who would later take the name Ho Chi Minh, tried to see President Wilson at the Paris Peace Conference to plead his case for Vietnamese independence. He failed in this effort, at which point he went to Moscow, where the new Bolshevik government was more than willing to support any efforts that would weaken the capitalist European powers then attempting to overthrow them. Ho, thus, was a communist and a nationalist. In fact, Americans would have a difficult time understanding and accepting during the Cold War. We still do, for reasons to be discussed later in this lecture. Now, during World War II, the United States had supported decolonization of Indochina, with Roosevelt explicit and emphatic in his condemnation of all colonialism and French Indochina, his prime example of the worst aspects of colonialism. After 100 years of French rule in Indochina, he said at one point, the inhabitants were worse off than they were before. And in Indochina, Ho and his Viet Minh organization worked with American agents of the Office of Strategic Services, the World War II predecessor to the CIA, to launch guerrilla attacks against the Japanese, who had seized control from a French puppet government in 1945. Ho and the Americans worked well together. And after the Japanese surrender, Ho announced the independence of Vietnam from France with words taken directly from the 1776 American Declaration of Independence from England. By 1945, however, both Roosevelt and his successor, Harry Truman, were having second thoughts about decolonization. And as the Cold War developed and increased in intensity from 1946 to 1949, so did American support for its European allies with colonial empires. The final blows to any American support for Ho, or even neutrality during his ensuing war with the French, were the 1949 communist victory in China and the 1950 Korean War. From that point onward, the United States was determined to contain communism in Asia. It was also determined to rebuild Japan as its major ally in the area and as a counterweight to communist China. Vietnam was seen as critical to this effort, at least partially because of its geographic proximity to the resource-rich Dutch East Indies, soon to become Indonesia, and British Malaya. In an extraordinary irony, the United States was now, in effect, fighting to obtain for Japan the economic component of the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere that it had fought to deny Japan during World War II. Please note in this regard that Japanese military movements into French Indochina led to the American freezing of Japanese assets in 1941 that in turn led to Pearl Harbor. Now, as previously noted, American support for the French in the early 1950s failed to change the outcome of this war in Vietnam. The United States did consider, but eventually rejected, a military intervention to save Dien Bien Phu. The Army Chief of Staff General Matthew Ridgway was particularly strong in his dissent against this idea. And the French at the 1954 Geneva Conference agreed to recognize Vietnamese independence as well as the independence of Laos and Cambodia. Vietnam itself was temporarily divided at the 17th parallel, with French forces to withdraw south of that line and Viet Minh forces north of that line. Unification elections were to be held in 2 years. The United States refused to sign the Geneva Accords. It did state that it would not disturb them by force, but privately it labeled them a, quote, disaster that would lead to the communization of all of Southeast Asia. President Eisenhower publicly voiced this fear in his famous reference to a row of dominoes falling after the first one had fallen, an analogy that would become known as the domino theory. To prevent this from happening, the United States searched for and found an anti-communist Vietnamese nationalist in Diem, who was then living in exile in the United States. And the Americans hoped that Diem could establish an anti-communist alternative to Ho in the South. In the South at that point was a French puppet government known as the Republic of Vietnam, with its headquarters in Saigon. If Diem could establish a successful government in the South, it would prevent any further expansion of communism into Southeast Asia. It would also prevent Democrats at home from claiming that Republicans had lost Indochina, much as the Republicans had previously accused the Democrats of having lost China. Diem succeeded in wresting control of the South Vietnamese puppet government from Emperor Bao Dai, who had been both a Japanese and a French puppet. And with it, Diem obtained temporary control of the area below the 17th parallel. Now, by the Geneva Accords of 1954, that area was to remain separated from the North until unification elections in 1956. Taking advantage of this time period, the United States poured aid into South Vietnam, created the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization to defend the area, and supported GM's refusal to hold elections in 1956. Eisenhower and others noting that had they been held, the North would have won. In effect, the United States had decided not so much to defend South Vietnam as to create it as a non-communist alternative to the North and as part of the global effort to contain communism. Nation building as a major U.S. policy did not begin in the 21st century, but in the mid-20th century. Now, on the surface, South Vietnam appeared to be a brilliant success in nation building. Indeed, it became a showcase of what American aid could do. But beneath the surface, Diem's government was always in serious trouble. And that trouble led the United States into deeper and deeper commitments to salvage what it had helped to create. Within a few years, Diem had alienated much of the population in the South. He was a centralizer and a Catholic in an area historically decentralized and Buddhist. And as he moved to eliminate his political opponents, they fled to the old Viet Minh cadres. They formed the National Liberation Front and conducted guerrilla warfare against Diem. By 1959, Ho's communist government in the North, unwilling to accept the cancellation of elections and the permanent division of the country, had decided to support this insurgency with military aid and forces. The new Kennedy administration strongly believed in the doctrine of counterinsurgency as a way to counter communist guerrillas globally. It therefore decided to send in the newly created Special Forces, or Green Berets, as well as other military forces, to stop the communists by winning the hearts and minds of the South Vietnamese people. By 1963, that effort had failed miserably, and the United States then sanctioned a military coup that overthrew and assassinated Diem. But that only made the situation worse, with ensuing military coup after military coup just adding to the instability of the government and failure in the war against the communists. Indeed, by 1964-65, the communists were about to win. That was one of the two major reasons Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson, decided to escalate the American involvement via the bombing of North Vietnam in retaliation for two supposed attacks on U.S. warships in the Tonkin Gulf. That event we will examine in greater detail in the next lecture. The second major reason for Johnson's escalation was politics. 1964 was a presidential election year, and Johnson wished to neutralize the issue of Vietnam in his campaign against Republican Barry Goldwater. The bombing and the Tonkin Gulf resolution served this latter purpose very well, and Johnson swept to a stunning victory over Goldwater in the November 1964 elections. But it had much less of an impact on the Vietnamese communists, who were not scared off by Johnson's actions and who continued their successful military campaigns. Consequently, Johnson decided in April of 1965 both to launch a sustained bombing campaign against the North instead of merely retaliatory bombing, and to send combat troops into the South, officially to defend U.S. air bases, but in reality to conduct combat operations against the communists as well. By June of 1965, the armed forces had made clear that they would need hundreds of thousands of troops and a new strategy, search and destroy. Johnson agreed, once again, both to stop a communist victory and for domestic political reasons, this time to obtain passage of his Great Society bills, as well as head off any Republican charge of being soft on communism and losing Vietnam. By 1968, American forces numbered over 500,000. They had succeeded in preventing the communists from winning, but not in defeating them. To do that, it became clear after the communist Tet Offensive of early 1968 would require hundreds of thousands of more troops and placing the United States on a war footing with no end in sight and no guarantee of eventual victory. In addition to misunderstanding the nature of the war, the United States had grossly miscalculated the enemy's will, perhaps because it tended to view the enemy in Cold War terms as merely puppets of the Soviet Union rather than as fierce nationalists. To make matters worse, the war was by this time ripping the country apart and severely weakening United States' global military containment of the Soviet Union everywhere else. Vietnam by this point contained a very high percentage of American ground, naval, and air forces, including 40% of all U.S. combat-ready divisions, one-half of U.S. tactical air power, and one-third of its naval strength, meaning those forces were not available to be used anywhere else in the world. The war was also leading to a severe questioning of American policy by its European allies, with the possibility of losing those allies. It was also leading to increased prestige and influence for the Soviets in the entire Third World, which for obvious reasons viewed the American war effort as neo-colonial rather than anti-communist. The war destroyed the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, who in the spring of 1968 decided not to run for re-election. His successor, Richard Nixon, realized the failure of Johnson's Americanization of the war and the damage it was doing both domestically and internationally. But like his predecessors, and for the same reasons, he would not accept defeat. Instead, he began the process of Vietnamization and the de-escalation of the American military presence in South Vietnam, but combined with an expansion of the air war against the North to force it to agree to American terms at the Paris peace talks. He also believed that with détente, the Soviets would lessen their military support of the North and apply diplomatic pressure. All of this failed as badly as the efforts of his predecessors. Nixon did obtain with the Paris Peace Accords a return of American prisoners of war, an armistice in place, and the ability to remove the last U.S. combat forces from Vietnam, but no lessening of communist pressure. North Vietnam used the Sino-Soviet split to get aid from both China and Russia. The Soviets, in addition, refused to see détente as including Vietnam. And the South Vietnamese government continued to be weak, corrupt, and totally reliant on American aid and unable to win national support from the population. It thus collapsed with incredible rapidity in the face of a North Vietnamese offensive in 1975. So did the Nixon presidency by this time. Nixon resigned under threat of impeachment and conviction for his role in the Watergate break-in to Democratic National Headquarters during the 1972 election campaign and for the ensuing cover-up. Now, on the surface, this is purely a domestic issue. It has nothing to do with the Vietnam War. But beneath the surface, it had a great deal to do with the Vietnam War. The Watergate break-in and a host of related illegal activities had involved members of the Committee for the Re-election of the President, the acronym CREEP, former CIA operatives, and members of a group known as the Plumbers. The Plumbers had been formed to stop leaks of classified information having to do with Nixon's foreign policy in general and Vietnam in particular. Leaks such as Daniel Ellsberg's release of the classified Pentagon Papers on the history of the Vietnam War. Now, while the administration sought to stop future leaks by charging Ellsberg with a crime and prosecuting him in the courts, the Plumbers broke the law by breaking into the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist in an attempt to find incriminating evidence against him. This effort soon broadened into a host of illegal operations against the entire anti-Vietnam War movement and eventually against any opposition to Nixon, including the Democratic Party. Thus, the break-in to Democratic headquarters in the Watergate building was part and parcel of a much larger issue. The Watergate break-in was just the tip of the Watergate iceberg. Indirectly, then, the Vietnam War destroyed two presidencies, that of Nixon as well as that of Johnson. The links are not obvious on the surface, but they are definitely connected. And one task of the skeptic is to look for and find such historical connections that may not be apparent. Now, why did the Americans fail? There were, of course, many additional reasons to those analyzed here for the American failure. To name but a few, Johnson's incremental bombing campaign against the North faced a lack of effective targets and totally failed to intimidate the North Vietnamese. It was also based on the very questionable doctrine that strategic bombing could force an enemy to surrender. Furthermore, the Army search and destroy strategy led to massive civilian casualties and destroyed the very society the United States was trying to create. Indeed, some have argued that the United States never really had a clear strategy. Now, many other factors could be listed and analyzed, but the basic problem that underlay all the others was the insistence on viewing the war in Cold War terms rather than Third World nationalist terms. And along with this went the related ignorance of Vietnamese history and culture. That ignorance actually was at least partially the result of the Cold War. For during the McCarthy era in the 1950s, many, if not most, of our few Asian experts had been purged from the State Department for their policies and their prophecies regarding China. That ignorance of Vietnamese history and culture resulted in a subsequent underestimation of both the willingness of Hanoi to face American firepower and suffer massive casualties, and the difficulty of creating an effective South Vietnamese government. Furthermore, since Washington viewed Vietnam as part of the global Cold War, it did not, Indeed, it could not ever make Vietnam its top priority. In effect, every administration put into Vietnam only what was necessary to avoid defeat during its watch, not enough to win. As one high-ranking Defense Department official, Assistant Secretary of Defense John McNaughton, would admit in 1965, a full 70% of the reason for the bombing of the North was to avoid a humiliating defeat. Even the more than 500,000 troops that Johnson sent was not enough. Given Hanoi's ability to send 200,000 soldiers a year into the South and the length and size of the enormous American logistical tail, closer to 2 million soldiers would have been needed. And that was utterly impossible given America's global commitments and priorities. In addition, those troops would have probably been needed for a decade or more, given the Asian as opposed to the Western concept of time. As Chinese Communist leader Chou Enlai supposedly said when asked for his views on the significance of the 18th century French Revolution, it is too soon to say. And Vietnamese nationalists viewed their struggle through the lens of nearly a century of struggle against the French and 1,000 years against the Chinese. This decision by each administration only to do what was necessary to avoid defeat during his watch was also motivated by domestic factors, most notably a desire not to be charged by your political opponents with being soft on communism or having lost Indochina. Ironically, or perhaps appropriately in light of these facts, the American failure in Vietnam had far more negative domestic consequences than international ones. Contrary to domino theory, it did not lead to the communization of all of Southeast Asia. And the nations in which the communists did triumph soon went to war with each other. Vietnam invading Cambodia, China invading Vietnam, while China and Russia almost went to the verge of total war. Does that sound like monolithic communism? Nor did the American failure in Vietnam seriously affect the global balance of power between the United States and the Soviet Union. But it massively affected the United States domestically, ripping the country apart, destroying two presidencies, and ending the bipartisan consensus in foreign affairs that had existed since World War II. It also led for the first time to a shattering of the faith of many Americans in their government and indeed their country. Decades after the Vietnam War and the Cold War ended, we still live with these negative consequences and their aftermath. Ever since the war ended, Americans have either sought to ignore it or else to draw analogies between the Vietnam War and more recent military interventions. The problem with such analogies is that one tends to look for events in the past that will support one's pre-existing position on any contemporary issue and to ignore contrary historical analogies, even though they might be more appropriate. There is also a related tendency to look for analogies to events in one's own lifetime only, rather than the distant past. Illustrating both points was the proper analogy in search for historical lessons for the Cold War and Vietnam. Was it the 1930s, as most Americans thought, or were the events and lessons of the long Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta 2,500 years earlier more appropriate? In addition to this, every event in history is unique. History does not repeat itself, and every analogy is thus inherently flawed. A colleague of mine, when asked about analogies during the 1980s between El Salvador and Vietnam, said there were none. But how do you compare what occurred in Southeast Asia with what was occurring in Central America? But we apparently insist upon drawing historical analogies anyway. And if we are ignorant of history, we will draw them only from what we have experienced in our own lifetimes. A deep knowledge of history can avoid that. And with it, perhaps, some of the worst pitfalls of historical analogies. And while history does not repeat itself, patterns of human behavior do. For Vietnam, perhaps most important lessons are in that realm, in particular, the tragedies of faulty perceptions that result from historical and cultural ignorance.
Lecture 22, Myths About American Wars.
In the last lecture, we examined some of the major misunderstandings associated with the Vietnam War. But Vietnam is far from the only American war that is misunderstood. Indeed, numerous misunderstandings exist about most American wars. So do numerous myths. One major myth concerns our tradition of citizen soldiers to fight our wars, a tradition that began in the colonial era with every able-bodied male colonist supposedly ready to grab his trusty musket off the mantelpiece of his home and go out to successfully defend his community, be it against Indians, or the French, or the Spanish, or during the Revolutionary War against the British. Now, as with most myths, this one contains an element of truth, indeed much more than simply an element. During the 17th century, colonists had to rely upon themselves for defense, and they thus created in the New World, from English tradition, the militia system, in which every able-bodied adult male in the community was a member and liable for military training on muster days, as well as military service when called up. Militia were heavily involved in the Revolutionary War, and the militia system was enshrined in federal law after the Revolutionary War with the Militia Act of 1792. That remained the basic military legislation for the country until the early 20th century. But in reality, the muster days during the colonial era were more social events than occasions for military training, and the militia proved to be an unreliable as well as an untrained body of soldiers. Their members came and went as they pleased, and their elected or politically appointed officers were anything but competent. There were also numerous exemptions from military service, and the system was in a state of serious decay, if not outright collapse, by the time of the Revolutionary War. Now, the war did witness a major revival of the militia system, but its members, for the most part, remained unreliable and unable to stand up to British regulars, especially a British bayonet charge. Washington consequently placed little faith in the militia and instead focused during the war on the creation and the rigorous training of his Continental Army to fight the British regulars. Militia did play a crucial role in numerous battles and in winning the war, but only when properly led and primarily in conjunction with the Continental Army. Had Washington been able to have his way, little reliance would have been placed on militia after the war. But realizing that would be politically impossible, as well as ideologically and practically impossible, Washington called for a system whereby the central government would control the militia and impose uniformity on it in terms of arms, organization, and training. But that proved to be equally impossible. Consequently, a dual defense system emerged under the Constitution. It consisted of a small professional army and the state militia, with authority over state militia split between the national and state governments. But with the passage of the Militia Act of 1792, what that actually translated into was no centralized control and no uniformity. All males aged 18 to 45 were required by this act to enroll in the militia, but there was no federal control over training, arms, or officer selection. Primary reliance was thus placed not on the militia, but on a small professional army augmented by volunteers in times of war, as well as a draft during the Civil War, and on special elite volunteer militia units that had begun to form in the colonial era. These gradually evolved during the late 19th century into the present-day National Guard. Now, militia units were used during the 19th century, usually with disappointing results. They did very poorly during the War of 1812, and their lawless behavior during the war with Mexico was so outrageous that the Mexicans labeled them, quote, bandits vomited from hell. Regular officers concurred, and there was little love lost between militia and the regular army. Indeed, regular army reformers consistently called for either an end to the militia system or strong federal control over it. The National Guard did come under greater federal control during the 20th century, but during the two world wars and the Cold War, primary reliance for manpower was placed upon a national draft. A system of universal military training was proposed, but it never passed. Consequently, we retain today the dual system of a regular army and elite volunteer militia units. But that is not the citizen-soldier concept of universal military obligation and service. That, as well as the belief that untrained or poorly trained citizens can defeat regulars, is part of our national mythology. Another major myth is that we and our leaders only go to war for defensive reasons and when forced by aggressors to do so. In this regard, many view the decision by President George W. Bush to go to war against Iraq in 2003 as an anomaly, a break from past American history and traditions. It is not. The fact that we went to war in Iraq on the basis of faulty or manipulated intelligence regarding weapons of mass destruction is also viewed incorrectly as an anomaly in American history. In reality, numerous past presidents have presented incorrect information, sometimes knowingly, sometimes unknowingly, in order to obtain congressional and public approval of war. Similarly incorrect is the belief that we Americans always, quote, win the war but lose the peace because of our political naivete. In point of fact, the reverse has often been the case. The rest of this lecture will attempt to dispel such myths by examining presidential behavior prior to America's major wars, as well as the military history of those wars and the political results. Let's look first at the issue of defensive wars versus wars by choice. Historically, many, if not most, of our wars have been wars by choice. In point of fact, only World War I and World War II were wars in which we were actually forced to declare war by the previous actions of our enemies. In the 19th century, both the 1846-48 war with Mexico and the 1898 war with Spain were wars by choice. The first to acquire California and New Mexico, as well as a favorable boundary for Texas, and the second to force the Spanish out of Cuba. Similarly, in the 20th century, we chose to go to war in Korea and in Vietnam in the 1960s as part of the Cold War. In a somewhat gray area is the War of 1812, as President Madison and the Congress went to war in desperation because of the failure of their previous measures of economic coercion designed to force the British to cease violating American neutral rights on the high seas. Well, what about the Civil War? The South chose to secede and to fight for independence, while the North chose war in order to prevent this. Similarly, Americans chose to fight against what they saw as British violations of their rights in 1775, while Britain chose to crush their rebellion by force. Even in the two world wars, our enemies argued that our previous non-neutral acts had made us an unofficial belligerent and forced them to attack us. In 1917, it was our booming trade in war material and our loans to the Allied powers that led the Germans to announce unrestricted submarine warfare against our shipping, as well as everybody else's. In 1941, it was our freezing of Japanese assets, which in effect embargoed the oil and steel that Japan relied upon. And that is what led Tokyo to try to obtain these resources by force in Southeast Asia. And to attack the only military force capable of stopping them, the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor. Similarly, the decision via the Lend-Lease Act of 1941 to give war material free of charge, first to Britain and eventually to the Soviet Union, and then to use the U.S. Navy to help convoy that war material across the Atlantic, made the United States an unofficial belligerent in the war against Germany. In all of these wars, we argued that our enemies left us no choice but to go to war. but because we made such a claim does not mean that it was true. Well, what about incorrect and or manipulated evidence for going to war? In 1846, President James K. Polk manipulated both the evidence and the way it was presented so as to leave the Congress with no choice save to declare war. First, he sent an army under General Zachary Taylor into disputed territory along the Rio Grande River. And when Taylor's army clashed with the Mexican army, Polk asked Congress for war on the grounds that, quote, American blood had been shed upon American soil. But it was disputed soil, not American soil, as a one-term Illinois congressman named Abraham Lincoln and others would point out. Indeed, Lincoln would get the nickname Spotty for asking Polk to identify the spot on which American blood had been shed upon American soil. In addition to this, Polk may very well have sent Taylor's army into the disputed territory to provoke a war, as he was determined to obtain California, and his efforts to do so by diplomatic negotiation had failed. Now, in addition to all this, congressional Democrats attached the war resolution as a rider to a military appropriations bill for the Army. And a portion of that Army was then engaged in hostilities. That made it nearly impossible to vote against the measure. Jumping to World War II, in September of 1941, President Franklin D. Roosevelt claimed that the U.S. destroyer Greer had been, quote, wantonly attacked by a German submarine in the Atlantic. And he responded as commander-in-chief with an order for U.S. warships to shoot on sight when they spotted German submarines. That began an undeclared naval war with Nazi Germany, one that became official when Hitler declared war on the United States soon after Pearl Harbor. But in reality, the Greer had been trailing the German submarine and radioing its position back to a British fleet that had responded with air attacks against the sub. The submarine had fired on the Greer in self-defense. Now, more common historically than such blatant manipulation of the facts has been the presentation of evidence that was believed at the time, but that later research showed to be incorrect. One of the major factors the President James Madison cited in asking Congress for a declaration of war in June of 1812 were the British orders in council that Madison claimed violated American neutral rights. Actually, those orders in council had already been rescinded, but neither Madison nor the Congress knew that in June of 1812 because the news could not travel to America that rapidly. The only way was sailing ship. And it arrived, the news arrived, after war had already been declared. In 1898, one of the major reasons Congress declared war on Spain was the sinking of the U.S. battleship Maine in Havana Harbor, a sinking that two Navy boards of inquiry concluded had been caused by an external mine and that the public believed obviously had been planted there by the Spanish. But no evidence was ever presented that the Spanish had been responsible for the mine. And in the 1970s, a detailed Navy study concluded that the previous boards of inquiry had been incorrect and that in all likelihood, the Maine had been destroyed by an internal explosion caused by spontaneous combustion in a coal bunker. That then ignited a powder magazine and blew up the entire ship. In a separate category are war-causing events that were believed at the time because the administration wanted to believe them and consequently ignored contrary evidence. In August of 1964, President Lyndon Johnson and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara claimed that two attacks had taken place against American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin by North Vietnamese torpedo boats. They did this in order to obtain passage of the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, authorizing the president to use force to prevent future attacks. Johnson would later use that resolution to justify his ensuing Americanization of the Vietnam War. That had not been his aim in August of 1964. Rather, his aim had been to send a message to North Vietnam regarding American unity and seriousness of purpose, and, as I previously noted, to neutralize the issue of Vietnam in the 1964 presidential election campaign. For those reasons, the administration had prepared this resolution months earlier and was simply waiting for an episode to justify presenting it. It thus chose to ignore contrary evidence arriving that the second attack may never have taken place. The first attack clearly did, but that the second attack had never taken place, that the blips on U.S. sonar were actually caused by the wakes of the ships as they took evasive action that was not needed. Second supposed attack took place at night. The administration also chose to ignore its own actions that had probably led to the first attack. In particular, DeSoto intelligence gathering missions with warships running into North Vietnamese territorial waters and then racing out, and O-Plan 34A operations against the North Vietnamese coast by South Vietnamese commandos who were transported in American naval vessels. Similarly, the Bush administration nearly 40 years later relied on faulty intelligence to claim that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, and it ignored contrary evidence, in all likelihood because it had already decided to go to war and had convinced itself that the Iraqi dictator did possess such weapons. What about the cliche that the United States always wins the wars and loses the peace? Historically, the reverse has been the case more often. Militarily, the United States did not win the War of 1812, and politically, it did not lose the peace. To the contrary, its military forces were consistently defeated by the British in 1812 and in 1813. And in 1814, the British invaded and burned Washington. Only the last-minute turning back of a British assault on Baltimore and the turning back of a British invasion down the Champlain Valley at the Battle of Plattsburgh Bay prevented total defeat. Yet American diplomats at Ghent in Belgium proved superior to British diplomats and obtained a highly favorable peace treaty, one that ended previous British talk of obtaining American territory in the war and creating a separate Indian nation to block further American expansion. The peace treaty also implicitly accepted American sovereignty much more strongly than had the peace treaty of 1783 that ended the Revolutionary War. As for the neutral rights issues that had led the United States into a declaration of war, they were rendered immaterial because of the simultaneous end of the Napoleonic Wars. What about the war with Mexico, 1846 to 48? Here we won both the war and the peace. At least the peace President Polk had wanted when the war started. But as the war went on, Polk and many Americans thought more and more about acquiring all of Mexico, just annexing the entire country. Polk then accepted a more limited treaty that obtained his original territorial desires, California, New Mexico, the Rio Grande boundary. One reason he did so, and indeed one reason his peace envoy, Nicholas Trist, disobeyed orders. Polk had ordered him home. Trist disobeyed those orders and negotiated this peace treaty. Why? Because despite its military victories, the small army in Mexico City faced the risk of being cut off and having to deal with guerrilla warfare. The head of that army, General Winfield Scott, asked Trist to stay and to sign the peace treaty. What about the 1898 war with Spain? Here we also won the war and the peace. Indeed, we acquired an overseas empire that territorially went beyond what we had actually conquered during the war. As for World War I, contrary to popular belief, while the United States did play an important role in the eventual Allied victory, its participation in the war was brief, officially less than 2 years, in reality less than one on the actual battlefields. And the United States was not primarily responsible for the Allied victory. Indeed, the initial collapse of the German army and the Central Powers as a whole took place in areas far removed from American forces. Yet, the very limited role played by those forces was sufficient to enable President Woodrow Wilson to claim a dominant role at the Paris Peace Conference. Indeed, his only very firm instruction to General John J. Pershing was to keep the American army separate, not to allow it to be amalgamated into French and British forces, so that he would have a strong bargaining position at the Paris Peace Conference. Now, Wilson did not get everything he wanted at Paris, but the compromises in the Treaty of Versailles reflected most of what he wanted, most notably the League of Nations. That the League failed to keep the peace is not relevant. That is a separate issue. Similarly, and as discussed in a previous lecture, the United States did not win World War II all by itself. It provided only 25% of the Allied armed forces during that war. Nor did it lose the peace. First of all, there never was a peace to lose, as the Cold War precluded the negotiation of any peace treaty or even the calling of a peace conference. As for the claim that we nevertheless lost the peace to Joseph Stalin during the wartime Yalta Conference, a conference in which a supposedly naive Roosevelt gave away half of the world to Stalin, that very statement incorrectly assumes that Roosevelt possessed that half of the world to give away. As previously explained, he did not. Furthermore, despite its limited contribution to military victory, the United States emerged from World War II as by far the most powerful nation in the world, and indeed, the most powerful nation the world has ever seen. British historian A.J.P. Taylor once quipped that Roosevelt was the most successful, indeed, in some ways, the only successful World War II leader. He made the United States the greatest power in the world, Taylor noted, at a cost much lower than that of any other major belligerent. What about the Korean War? Militarily, that was a stalemate. Nevertheless, the United States did succeed in obtaining its original political goal. It did not succeed in obtaining the later one of liberating and unifying all of Korea, but it did succeed in the original goal, the halting of North Korean aggression and the maintenance of the pre-existing South Korea. In Vietnam, the United States clearly lost the war, even though it may never have lost a battle. Yet it achieved in the Paris Peace Accords what Nixon and Kissinger had desired regarding a, quote, decent interval for Vietnamization and the removal of American forces from what had clearly become a military quagmire. What about the first Iraq War? Here the United States succeeded both militarily and in its stated political goal of halting Iraq's aggression against Kuwait. Overthrowing Saddam Hussein was not in the original American or the UN sanction to go to war in Iraq. And of course, with the 1991 demise of the Soviet Union, the United States won the Cold War without ever having defeated a Soviet army. Well, why then, in light of all these facts, do we continue to believe that we do not start wars, that we only go to war in response to attacks upon us and on the basis of solid evidence, and that we always win the wars but lose the peace? To a large extent, these myths are the result of our bitterness and disappointment regarding the results of the wars we fought, especially the two world wars. That bitterness and disappointment was linked to our very unrealistic expectations regarding the ability of total military victory in a coalition war to translate into the total recreation of international relations in the image that we desired and that President Wilson and President Roosevelt enunciated. It didn't. It couldn't accomplish that. The two world wars and the nature of American democracy also helped to create a mythical belief that the only wars worth fighting are total wars for total victory and a total recreation of the world. None of that is true. The American belief that it is led State Department official George Kennan, who left the State Department and became a famous historian, led Kennan more than 60 years ago in a lecture to compare the United States to a prehistoric dinosaur with a body the size of a room, a large room, and a brain the size of a pin. You virtually have to whack its tail off, Kennan noted, to wake it up and make it aware that its interests are being threatened. But once awake, it responds with such fury over having been disturbed, and a response that has no limit, that it winds up destroying not only whoever has disturbed it, but its own habitat. Now, these myths are also part of our national mythology about ourselves, that we are a peace-loving people who only go to war when left with no choice, who are then militarily victorious against evil enemies because of our goodness as well as our military prowess and divine protection. But we are then foiled and defeated in the peacemaking because as a peace-loving people, we are naive about war and peacemaking. This national mythology is in turn based on a belief that war is evil and therefore should be undertaken only when we are attacked and there is no choice. That may be true. I definitely believe that it is true on moral grounds and on practical grounds as well. For war is almost always a great gamble whose outcome cannot be accurately predicted. But that does not mean that what we should do, avoid war unless we are attacked and there is no choice, is what we have actually done in our history. The mythology is also due to the fact that we tend to confuse success in battle with success in war. One of the most misnamed books of the late 20th century was a history of the German general staff entitled A Genius for War. As numerous critics pointed out, it should have been entitled A Genius for Battle, as starting and losing two world wars does not illustrate a genius for war. A Prussian military officer and theorist, Karl von Clausewitz, knew this, and he emphasized in his classic study on war, almost 200 years ago, that wars are fought for political goals and make sense only within that political context. Indeed, he argued, political goals should to a great extent determine the military strategy that is used, so that that strategy does not inadvertently negate the very reasons one went to war. War, Clausewitz pointed out, has a tendency to go to the absolute, which was mindless violence. Real war was fought for political goals, but war did have that tendency to the absolute unless it was controlled. Now, our failure to understand this and to understand the difference between war and battle was boldly illustrated after the Vietnam War by the American who commented to his Vietnamese counterpart that throughout the war, quote, we never lost a battle. That may be correct, the Vietnamese responded, but it is also irrelevant. George Washington came to understand that during the War for Independence, as he achieved the political goal of independence, despite the fact that his army lost most of its battles and won very few. But those few, as shown in an earlier lecture, were enough due to their political consequences. We have forgotten that lesson from our 18th century past. Perhaps that is because as our power has grown, so has our hubris, our pride, our arrogance, and our ensuing blindness to our own history.